Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Welcome to Cheaper Than Therapy, a podcast that journeys into conversations that demystify, destigmatize, and desensitize what goes on both inside the therapy room and in daily life.
I'm Vanessa Bennett.
And I'm Danae Logan.
And we are seekers, soul sisters, and holders of sacred space. Every week, we sit down for soul-provoking conversations with fellow seekers, thought leaders, change makers, and even real people during live coaching sessions as they navigate the hard work it takes to be a human.
This is Cheaper Than Therapy. How you doing, B?
I mean, I'm having a little bit of a fangirl moment over here.
You okay over there?
I have to say. There are those moments in one's life that you are hopefully graced with the presence of people who you look at as, you know, mentors or teachers on your journey. And Dr. Peter Levine is one of those for me. While I am not certified in somatic experiencing, I have taken programs that integrate a lot of it, and I work with a lot of the elements of SE in my own therapy work, my own personal work, and my own therapy work. And he is just, I don't know, he's profound. I feel so grateful that we got to spend an hour with him.
Yeah. There's just like, you know how it like really feels difficult to articulate the different spaces that he draws from in terms yes. of the depth of his wisdom. Like there's so much time that he's spent just with different cultures and indigenous populations and attempting to understand the way we negotiate trauma as human animals that you can tell this has been the love of his life, this inquiry. And it's so unbelievably inspiring to me to not only witness him speaking about it, but also that he's written this book that really encapsulates all of the wisdom he's gathered and where it's come from.
Yeah. And going into this, one of the questions I had written at the top with a star was just why this book now, right? Mm-hmm. Like, why did you write this book now? And I didn't even have to answer ask the question because I think he answered it in our conversation. Mm-hmm. But you know, I mean, he's been doing this work for 60 years. Yeah. And I think it's actually really, I don't know what the word, for some reason the word magical came up for me because for some reason that's this word that I attribute to him. I even told him so. But to be at this point in your life and say, like, he was a scientist first and foremost, right? Mm-hmm. And be able to be at this pivotal point in your life where, in his words, right, he has less years ahead of him than he does behind him. Mm-hmm. And write an autobiography that encapsulates, obviously, his personal story, but weaves it into and continues to provide such profound healing, I don't know, information, advice, tools, wisdom, all of these things. It's a treasure, I think, that he gave us this book. And he says multiple times in this conversation that it was hard for him, right, to be this vulnerable and give this kind of information. So I feel like I'm honored that he put it out into the world.
Hmm. Absolutely. I feel so struck. There was something about, as I was listening to him talk about the autobiography and how much it is just sort of weaved into the work that he does. You know, we talk about sometimes that like there's like the work and the job that you do.
Yeah.
Or sorry, excuse me. Like there's the job and the career that you have. And then there's your work in this yes. life. And there are those lucky humans who experience a life where they get to weave the two into one. And that is so much of what you can tell Dr. Levine's journey has mm-hmm. been that his life's work is so much of like who he is and like what he has had is like a love affair. And I find him so inspiring listening to him yeah. talk about it.
Yeah. And I will say too, I personally, I'll share that he's one of a couple mentors that I feel like, and I was saying this before we started recording, you know, he's like that uncle that you wish you had, right? Like so many of us have this disconnection from our actual elders or our actual ancestors. Mm-hmm. And when I listen to him speak, it's like the uncle that I wish I could sit with him in an armchair and me on the floor, just listening to him tell stories about his life and taking in the wisdom mm-hmm. that is him, right? And it makes me realize in my body kind of how hungry I am for that kind of wisdom. And I think it translates into us as a people, right? As into a society that we've lost a lot of that connection to those wise elders, right? So for those of you who don't know Dr. Peter Levine, buckle up. This will be a gateway for you into the million books that he has written about trauma. He's one of the absolute OGs in the trauma world. For those of you who do know Dr. Levine, his book is actually... it's out now, an autobiography of trauma. And we're going to link everything in the show notes. So don't worry about that. But I'm going to read his bio for those of you who don't know. So Dr. Peter Levine is the developer of somatic experiencing. Some of you know it as SE, a naturalistic and neurobiological approach to healing trauma, which he has developed over the past 50 years. He holds a doctorate in biophysics from UC Berkeley and a doctorate in psychology from International University. He is the founder and president of the Aragos Institute for Somatic Education, dedicated to community outreach and post-advanced somatic experiencing training, and the founder and advisor for Somatic Experiencing International. He has taught at the University of California, Berkeley, Mills College, Antioch, CIIS, and the Santa Barbara Graduate Institute, and his work has been taught to over 30,000 therapists in over 42 countries. I won't even go into all of the amazing books that he has written. I will say Walking the Tiger was one that was huge for me. In an Unspoken Voice was another huge one for me, but we can't link them all, guys. The show notes are only so long. So just go to his website. And also his nonprofit is linked out in his website as well. And he wanted to make sure that we called that out. So if you're interested, check it out. And I don't know, enjoy this conversation. I'm still buzzing. Well, I cannot express how much gratitude I have to have Dr. Peter Levine sitting here with us right now. You have been one of the biggest mentors and teachers for me in my work, not only in my own personal work and journey, but also as a therapist. And I know you have impacted more people than we can count. So we're so appreciative that you're here.
Well, thank you. Very kind.
So there's so much. You have an amazing new book out, and we just can't wait to get into all of the things. I have like lists of questions, but as Danae and I do, because we come from a depth psychology background, we also want to pay honor to allowing the psyche to lead a little bit.
Sure.
But we want to start with, as we start with everybody that comes on our show, kind of, I mean, it's a long journey for you, I'm sure, but really if you could give our audience, maybe who have never been introduced to you and your work, like a synopsis of how did you get here? How did you become who you are, right? Like, what was that journey like for you? I know. I don't know how we're going to fit it in, but if you could.
Done a lot of things.
right. I mean, basically, my introduction to trauma was in the 1960s, late 1960s. Mm. And at that time, there was no definition of trauma as PTSD the way it is now. Mm. So I had the advantage of not knowing that trauma is not a brain disorder or a brain disease, mm. but it's something very, very different. It's something that happens in the body. Mm, yes. Because when the definition as PTSD came out, it was really seen, and this was like 1981 or 82, and that was the wisdom of the day, that the most you could do is help people with medications or helping them to change some of their negative thoughts. And so that was about it. And if you can believe it, when I first published Waking the Tiger, there was only one other book on trauma.
Wow.
And that was Judith Herman's Trauma and Recovery. Very important book. Very important book. Anyhow, and now there are, I would say, probably 1,000 books on trauma. So it's interesting how it's coming into the mainstream. But again, what I first came to realize is when we're frightened or overwhelmed or startled, these are things that the body does.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, if you just went outside and you saw somebody was injured, you'd likely get a twisting in your gut. And then if you see that person's really injured, then that twisting gets even more. And then let's say that next night when you're going to bed, all of a sudden you see an image of that person. And again, you notice your guts are twisting. And so, or your body is bracing against being hit, say as a child being hit by somebody, or just hit emotionally and our shoulders go up like this to protect ourselves. Mm-hmm. Well, when that happens repetitively, the body is literally telling the mind that the trauma is still occurring.
Mm-hmm.
So the brain first recognizes the injury and recognizes it and gives us a body reaction. But when the body reaction maintains itself, then it keeps recirculating as continuing trauma, as the trauma is continuing over and over. And that won't change my experience until we change that information that's coming from the body to the brain. Mm-hmm. So here's again, I'm bracing against being hit. So I might just say, because I would very likely notice that if I were working with somebody, and I might gradually bring their attention to it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people have chronic pain, and then there's if it's chronic pain, unless there's an actual injury or something like that, it's almost always due to prolonged tension. So again, you can try this, because most of us do have some tension in our shoulders. So I might ask the person, well, if the tension even increased more in your shoulders, would your shoulders want to move? Could they move? Yes, they would move. They would go up towards my ears. Mm-hmm. Okay, now, if you can do that very slowly and really, really put your mind to it and just let them go up a little bit and then release. And then just wait and notice what's going on in your body. Mm-hmm. So there's most likely to be a discharge. There might be tingling, vibration, gentle shaking, trembling, and so forth. Feeling of more spaciousness. So these are, again, all the things that the body does that informs the mind that they should be on threat alert, even though there's no actual danger.
Yeah.
Dr. Levine, I'm curious, as someone who really pioneered the conversation around trauma, what your thoughts are on the way that we talk about trauma today. You know, you were saying initially there was only one other book where people were exploring it as a concept. How do you feel about the extent to which it almost feels like everything is trauma, or we've sort of made the conversation about trauma so much of our, a part of our cultural vernacular that it almost sometimes feels minimizing?
Yeah. I'm afraid almost don't know how to answer that question. I mean, trauma is the most belittled, ignored, important cause of suffering and illness in the world. And then on the other side, everything becomes trauma.
Right.
Now, things can affect us, but it doesn't mean that they're trauma, at least in the sense of PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I've learned in working with people for 50 years is that trauma is trauma no matter what the source, no matter what causes it. I wouldn't even use the word. I would say that our bodies, our psyche get overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. You know, probably one of the best definitions of trauma is the one that Freud proposed in, I think it was 1960. Now, this was before he went off in that tangent about people wanting to sleep with their mothers. And he wrote that trauma is a breach in the protective barrier against stimulation leading to feelings of overwhelming helplessness. Mm-hmm. I would just change it to trauma is a breach in the protective barrier against overstimulation mm-hmm. leading to feelings of overwhelming helplessness. Mm. I think that's a pretty good, you know, pretty good description of, you know, of how trauma affects us. So again, when I work with people, I'm long retired from actually doing, you know, private sessions, but so many things may have occurred in the person's life, or not even in their life, but in the life of their parents, grandparents, great-great-grandparents,
right,
so forth. And that was one of the things that I really started to realize when I was working with more and more people, that it didn't start here. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine, a colleague, wrote a very nice book. I think it says it's called "It Didn't
Start with You."
It didn't start with
didn't
you.
Start
yeah,
with Mark, you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And so it's now, I think people are really looking at this much more seriously. When mm-hmm. I first talked about it, I was considered to be a little bit wacko. I mean, mm-hmm. how could somebody affect something that happened to your generation? Mm-hmm. And we know, of course, now that the epigenetic transmission is significant, can mm-hmm. be very significant, but it's more than that. We get specific information from our ancestors, not just trauma, but in some cases, life preserving or life enhancing information. I think the first time I came to understand this was, it must have been 1989. There was a famous airplane crash, United 232. Mm-hmm. from Denver to Chicago, and the rear engine, DC-10, blew out, and it cut all the hydraulic lines, so the mm-hmm. plane couldn't steer. Mm-hmm. So what they tried to do is just use the engines, like put one engine stronger and then the other and so forth, to try to get it at least a little bit stabilized. So they landed in a regional airport, small airport, and the fuselage broke into pieces. There were fireballs and so forth. And so I'm working with this one woman who was in that flight. And in somatic experience, I talk about this quite extensively in the autobiography. Mm-hmm. We don't go for people's traumas. We go to the place where they first felt safe or cared for. Mm-hmm. And so Katie, that's the name I'll give her, her body took her out into this cornfield where she could feel the sun on her back, and she knew that she survived, that she mm-hmm. was safe. So then we go back to in the airplane. She's upside down now because the fuselage is turned upside down, and she just slowly opens the seatbelt and lets herself down to the ground. It's dark, it's black, there's smoke. She doesn't know what to do. And she hears these words, "Katie, go to the light, mm-hmm. go to the light and escape." And she saw a pinpoint of light. Mm-hmm. And so she crawled there and then was able to escape. But where did that come from? "Katie, go to the light, escape." Mm-hmm. Those are the words that she heard. Well, it turns out that both her father and grandfather were in airplane crashes, mm-hmm. and they both survived by crawling oh, through the light. So this life-saving information got passed along. So, and I think that's really important to understand mm. how valuable and life-saving. You know, I was doing a workshop at Esalen some years ago. And I happened to be working together with a young man who was from the Crow Nation and a young woman who was Navajo. And what came up in the session was this chant in the man's own language from a grandfather, great grandfather, and the words, this chant just came through him. And we were all so, I can imagine, really deeply moved.
Yeah. That's interesting, right? Like this idea of, we've been talking a lot, I feel like, in today's society about ancestral trauma and healing ancestral trauma. But to hear you talk about how there is both trauma that is passed down and also life-saving wisdom, right? That feels empowering.
Life-enhancing wisdom.
Life-enhancing, right. That's a better way to put it. It feels so, so powerful. And kind of power giving when I can say, yes, of course, this trauma was passed down, and also these life affirming, these life giving, strategies or whatever also, right, were given to me. And those are just as important, if not more important.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, when I first started, well, if it's okay, let me just kind of to orient to that question. If I can talk a little bit about the book I just finished, The Autobiography of Trauma.
Please.
Yeah. First of all, talking about not going directly into the trauma. Number of things happened to me which were quite violent and where I was deeply unsupported in a situation where there was literally life threat. And so I was starting to experience some disturbing sensations and flashes of images. And this must have been about 30 years ago. And so I decided it was time for me to take a dose of my own medicine. You know, Chiron from the Greek, the way I understand it, it's the wounded healer.
Right.
And we're all wounded in our own ways. If we're healers, we have to deal with our own wounding. It's essential. Otherwise, we can't really be present for our clients, for another person. So the following image, actually a memory came up when I was about 4 or 5 years old, and it was my birthday. And at night, my parents came into the bedroom, my bedroom, and laid a track for a model train. They went underneath the bed, out into the room, down again in an oval, and then back underneath the bed again. So I awoke, and you can imagine, well, I literally jumped out of bed. I ran over to the transformer, and I controlled the speed. And I also made the horn go, you know. In that moment, I knew that I was cared about, that I was. And there's a thing that's now pretty clear, that if somebody, even they had tremendous amount of trauma, if they had someone who cared for them, who loved them, they'll be okay. It might be some rough going, but they will be okay. So then this led to the following body sensations. I remembered when I would come home from school, must have been in the eighth grade, and I would run back home, I would eat my milk and my cookies, and I would just run to this park. And in the park, I would go down, because during this time, and this is really where so much of the trauma comes from, my father was asked to testify against the mafia don Johnny DiGuardo.
Wow.
He was the Al Capone of New York, and he was murderous. You know, the movie the Goodfellas and also the Irishman, he was portrayed as one as the most violent of all of those people, so you can imagine somebody you want to mess with. So and he basically told my father, or the mafia told my father, that if he testifies against Johnny Dio, that he will find his family face down in the East River. So our lives were threatened. Me and my brother knew something was wrong, but it was never talked about. And we were never told, it's okay, we're going to take care of you. This is a difficult time, but we will take care of you. So we didn't have that. I didn't have that message. So I really felt my life energy in a way draining. Mm-hmm. But when I would come home for my milk and cookies and jump over this wrought iron fence and down in the bushes, there was a running track, another oval. It's called the Reservoir Oval Park. It used to be a reservoir. And I would run on that cinder block running track. And I could start to feel life coming back into my legs. Mm-hmm. And again, I worked really to embody that sensation. So I'm working again with one of my students, who then she became my therapist, my guide. And I remember one time climbing the fence, and I knew something was wrong. And I could see off to the left, there was a bunch of, I'm sure they were mafia people. They were smoking mm-hmm. cigarettes. And they had these motorcycle hats. Like, and my body tensed. Mm. And I knew that something was wrong. I obviously didn't know what it was. So I tried to quickly go down into the bushes. But then somebody grabbed me from behind and threw me to the ground mm. where I was violently raped. Mm-hmm. And when I look back at it, actually in writing this autobiography, it was meant to only be for myself. I was never thinking about writing it as a book, but some friends really supported me to actually put it out there because it could help other people.
And yes,
I was convinced of that. So I did let it go. It was a difficult decision, believe mm-hmm. me. So, okay. So anyhow, I'm pretty sure that they did this for me to tell my parents to also put more pressure on them, more pressure on my father. At least that was what I kind of put together. But I never told my parents. Mm. And in a way, I didn't tell myself. Mm. And that's what happens when we've had severe trauma. That's often what happens.
Yeah.
We put it away. We wall it off. So it's not in our consciousness.
Yes.
It's there put it in the recesses of a corner. So getting back to when I was having these troubling sensations and images, that's when I again asked my student, my guide, to help me with this. And that's what came up. Hmm. But also that I wasn't destroyed by that. There was mm-hmm. still power in me. And that, again, was one of the important bases of somatic experiencing, is we go, again, not just for the trauma, but what supported the person's healing. The book, actually, the book is called An Autobiography of Trauma, A Healing Journey, mm-hmm. My Story. And by the way, I had, as I said, I didn't have any intention to publish it as a book. But one of my friends really encouraged me to do that. Mm. And also she let me reflect on what I was writing.
Yeah.
So she was really a tremendous support. And then the first time that I was talking about this book in public, it was in December. It was at the, what do they call it? Evolution of Psychotherapy Conference. Mm-hmm. Several thousand people.
Yeah. I saw you there a few years back.
Right.
I said, I saw you there pre-pandemic. I was there.
Oh, wow. Okay. Interesting. So anyhow, I just, I froze. I couldn't get the words out.
Yeah.
But then I remembered what some of my friends and colleagues and other people had written about the book, about me and about the book. And I literally could feel them at my side and supporting me from behind.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
And that support also allowed me to make this in public for the first time.
Yeah.
And now that the book is out, again, this was the last chance I had to not let it go out. And, but, oh, yeah, yeah. There's another side story about this as well. I know I'm kind of jumping around, but how do I want to put this? Well, I'll come back to it or not. But anyhow, clearly, this is something I was supposed to do. Oh, yeah, that's what I remember. The Lord was really encouraging me. I was really reticent. But I couldn't make up my mind. As I talk about it in the autobiography, some of the most important changes in my life came initially from dreams.
Right.
And so, you know, I was at best ambivalent. I was definitely anxious about doing that. And so I had the following dream. In the dream, I'm standing by a big field, large field. And in my hand, I'm holding a number of pages in both hands. And you could see it was a manuscript of some kind because it was typewritten. And I remember in the dream looking from left to right, right to left, in this indecision. In this indecision, a strong breeze came from behind me and took all of these papers and blew them into the air and down into that meadow to land where they might land. And so when I awoke, I realized that my decision had been made, that I was going to let it go wherever it landed. And I'm glad I followed that dream. It was difficult. Very difficult, but I really, and I'm glad so much that my friend really.
Well, Dr. Levine, first of all, just thank you so much for sharing that with us. And I think, I do think there's so much power in the liberation that others are able to find in the truths that we share that allow people to know that they are not alone with something that they have been carrying and maybe holding shame around. And, you know, I was thinking about something I've heard you say in talks in the past around, you know, that shame allows a child to feel like they have a modicum of control over situations, and how much that really sort of reframed the way that I think about like what that gives a child in a world of chaos when they feel like there are all of these things happening that I have no control over. But if it's mine and I did it and I'm responsible, then somehow that gives me this experience of control.
And that I'm bad and that I embody badness itself. Again, this is, you know, shame strangulates the spirit, the soul. And you know, I've thought about it. I found there's a specific posture of shame. And then I can work with people with this body posture very gradually, like at the beginning, very gradually going into it and coming out and going into it. And also coming to self-compassion, because that was the only way the child could feel that they had any control at all, which they didn't, because they were, you know, they were small and the adults were giants. So the only way we can get some sense that we're going to be okay is if we were the cause of our mistreatment, if it was our fault. And to change that, I think, you know, Gabor, one of the endorsements he wrote, was from searing pain, a journey from searing pain to joy, from self-hate to self-love. And again, gradually, as I worked these events and how I responded and who was there or who should have been there, you know, this thing started, my story started to unfold. And I believe that's true for all of us. That we all, well, we've all, anybody who's watching the podcast has had some kind of trauma. But it doesn't have to be a life sentence.
Yes.
And given the tools without tools, trauma rules with tools, trauma can be addressed. And also I deeply believe that we all have our own stories to tell.
Yes.
And in the book, I support people in trying to, in deciding to tell their story, even if it's only to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then to see, you know, where they would want to go from that. I think that was the message that I really wanted to get out, that bad stuff happens, but it doesn't have to be a life sentence.
And one of the things that I have always valued so much in watching you work and in studying SE and even reading this book is the way that you work with the body. Let me see if I can figure out how I want to frame this. There's a slowing down that is so imperative that as our world and our society continues to speed up,
right,
I find that is even harder to grasp sometimes and yet is so imperative in the actual releasing of the story of the shame of working with the trauma. Mm-hmm. I have actually used the words multiple times when I have told people who, you know, are not in this world or who don't know you. And I have said, watch him on YouTube work with somebody that pulls him from the audience. I've seen it live. He works. It's like you're watching a magician, because you don't know the tricks that are going on. And it's not tricks, obviously, but it's so subtle and it's so slow that it almost is like magic, Dr. Levine. And I know it's not, but I will say as an observer, that's what it seems like. Yeah.
Yes. And one of my jobs was to disprove that.
I know.
Something that was teachable, that was learnable. And, you know, Einstein said that there are two ways to look at the world. One is that nothing is a miracle, and the other is that everything is a miracle. And I think I'm okay. You know, people have said I was like a magician or a shaman. And again, at the time, because I wanted to make sure that the work would be recognizable. So I wanted to, you know, not say, oh, this is something only I could do, mm-hmm. or that I was a magician or a shaman, although I've had the great benefit over the years of meeting different shamans in different parts of the world. I also go over that, you know, in one of the chapters in the book. And I've learned so much from them, but not in the way I might thought it would come across.
Mm-hmm.
So, and about slowing down. Yes. Somatic experiencing is about slowing down in a world which is more and more speeding up. And often when, you know, I've worked with people and they work through some of this trauma and they've through slowing things down, through taking things step by step by step by step, they find that they're able to slow down more in their whole world, in
yes.
their whole life.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the gifts, the side effects of trauma resolved, trauma transformed, is we take a much slower way of being with ourselves.
Yes.
And being in the world. And goodness gracious, we need that at this in this time in time in history.
Well, and it feels a bit like maybe like pendulum is the word I'm thinking, because I can even recognize it in myself when I'm able to catch myself in a state of speeding everything up and getting a little ahead of myself. If I can stop and go back into the slowness and go back into my body, there's something that I've missed. There's something that I'm trying to avoid. There's something that I've skipped over, right? On purpose, that I'm attempting to run ahead of almost. Mm-hmm. Right. And so that's why I think so much of your work has been profound for me, even in my own work, is just sitting and saying, okay, you're getting a little too ahead of yourself. Why? There's something that you're running ahead of.
That's right. Or running away from. Yeah. I mean, look, we're all running away from stuff. That's just a given.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing that, we lose our essence. We lose what is really precious within ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, when I, at the last chapter in the book, It's titled Living My Dying Through the Eye of a Needle.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm at the age now where I clearly have less years in the future than I have had in the past. And that was the idea really of starting to pen this journal, which again mm-hmm. became the book. And at the end, I really felt like this circle that I came back to the child, the 18-month-old child, even though he had already experienced trauma, he still had vitality. He still had excitement. He still had, oh, let me show you the picture, actually. I think oh, yes, if that's okay.
Yes.
Oh, stop it.
Look at that face.
Yeah, and so that kind of took me full circle. Starting, you know, with the trauma of coming to through the trauma and then finally of coming back to myself. And so in Living My Dying, it's really living my living while I'm alive.
Dr. Levine, there's something I wanted to ask you about. I feel like it's one of those opportunities where we have you. I'm curious to pick your brain on something that, you know, you touch on psychedelics a little bit in the book. And it's something that I just have, you know, curiosity as well as complex feelings about as I witness it unfolding with a lot of my clients. And I think you hold sort of the interesting juxtaposition of sort of, you know, naming that psychedelics were a gateway to like certain areas of curiosity, but also such deep respect in the way you speak about indigenous populations and those traditions. And I'm just kind of curious to hear your thoughts on the psychedelic movement as it's showing up in trauma work today. I thought you might.
First of all, for full disclosure, I came to Berkeley in 1964. So it was all about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. But now I've looked at, and as the Judy Collins song goes, I've looked at clouds from both sides now. And I think what I write about it is use of psychedelics, promises and pitfalls.
Yes.
And a few things. First of all, it's not for everybody. And also, it's important to prepare for it and to do follow-up. And then not only to do follow-up, but to really make sure that this gets in the body. You know, there's a saying in Papua New Guinea that knowledge doesn't exist unless it's in the body, I think they say, unless it's in the muscles. And so that's vitally important, because otherwise, if we're just, as I did in the 60s, you know, just doing these catalysts, these psychedelics over and over again, it's not really sticking. Yes. It's not really changing how we are with ourselves and with our bodies. And that takes hard work. You know, I think I said something like, for every psychedelic experience, we need at least 4 or 5 15 or 20 non-catalyst follow-up work.
Yeah.
Everyone hear that?
Yeah.
Pause, everyone listening to Dr. Levine on that one?
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, and also, are you working with somebody who's really experienced, who really knows about trauma? And, you know, otherwise, again, it can just be, you know, going for the God molecule. And it's not that simple. It's not that simple. So again, I see great possibility, really good possibilities. And, you know, and I've spoken out, and I've spoken to some of the people who are doing some of the psychedelic work and some of the, you know, about my concerns. And I think that they've taken that, and I think that making changes. So again, it's like one of the things which I think is essential is before doing a psychedelic experience to just have the two therapists, usually it's a man and a woman, And the person is wearing the sleep mask, which is what mm-hmm. you do usually with psychedelic journeys, and earphones, mm-hmm. and just listening to the same types of sound or music, and to do that for at least a few hours. So you're doing something where you're really seeing what comes up. Mm-hmm. And then if it's time to do a journey, then at least you know that this is the right time to do it.
Right. Like your body has, in essence, been prepared in some way for what yes. it's going to go into so that it's exactly. not such a shock to the system. I mean, of course, yes. it's going to be, but that at least gives it some baseline of, yes. I know this.
Yeah. And you don't want to shock the nervous system.
Right.
Because often if you do that, then you just you reactivate the trauma. You know, in the somatic experiencing trainings, when I first started teaching what I was developing to a group of about 12 or 15 therapists from Berkeley, they would come out every week or two. They call it my treehouse in Wildcat Canyon, just outside of Berkeley. Mm. And I would, try to teach them what I was doing. Mm. And then strangely enough, I would work with somebody and then try to explain what I was doing. So again, doing this kind of thing before we do, a trip. Mm-hmm. And again, there are many psychedelics and they have different effects on different people. Mm-hmm. So again, it has a lot to know about it. And, it like so many things, it can become proselytizing that, that this is the answer for yes. everything. And I was going to say, oh, I wish it was. But in a way, I don't, because it wouldn't be the truth.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And actually, I'm jumping around here, but in writing the autobiography, the commitment I made to myself was that I would tell my truth no matter where it went, no matter where it went. And there's a Jewish saying that, how does it go? What is truer than truth? Mm-hmm. The answer, the story. And again, we all have our stories, our valuable stories to tell to ourselves and possibly to others, but to the right others, to the person who is respectful and yes. not just to tell it randomly, because that can be, we can be mobbed or abused.
Yes.
When we do that. So, yeah, getting back to slowing down, we really, in our society, things are going at such a that we don't have time to live.
No.
To really experience life, to experience deepening of relationships. I've been at a restaurant or different places and there's a whole bunch, or people going out on a date and they actually, what they're doing is looking at their phone.
Yes. Yeah.
They're not making any contact with each other. And we're becoming, Einstein said it, a nation of idiots, of emotional idiots, because we don't have that sense of connection to ourselves and connection with others. And that's really, I think, what life is about.
Yeah, you actually said in one of the chapters, you talked about society being fragmented. I wrote this down because it was so profound for me, and missing deep connection, right? You specifically told the story of the woman who had lost her twins and how you witnessed her being brought back into the community, right, through that community-based healing. And I just thought, we are such a people of a lack when it comes to that, we're so lonely.
Yeah, we're so lonely and so individual. I mean, and that has its positive aspects. Mm-hmm. This machine that I'm sitting in front and talking to you, that was something that was developed by people who were quite individualistic.
Yes.
But there's a high cost to that.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I was interested to find out maybe if I could a little bit more about how different shamanic cultures deal with trauma. And in Portuguese, Brazilian in Portuguese, and also I think probably also in Spanish, there's a word susto, S-U-S-T-O, and it literally means fright paralysis. So when I learned about that, I thought, oh wow, this must be about trauma. This must be about how they work with trauma. So I was visiting. I had the possibility to visit this this chief of the Krenaki tribe. It took us about 18 hours to get there, including 3 hours, 2 or 3 hours in the hot noonday sun. When finally got there, I mean, I was just sweating profusely. And the chief took me to this place right behind their house. There was a plastic pipe that went in between two rocks, and there was a spring there, so it was like a shower. So he took me there. I went under the shower, and finally I started to realize, oh gosh, I'm alive here. And then he invited me to come out with him on the other side of the house, and there was a mat, and we were sitting together underneath a mango tree. And he had a flute, and he was playing the flute, and there were a number of other flutes. And I asked him, I said, is it okay if I play the flute with you? And he said, that's why they're here. So the two of us were playing the flute together, and all of a sudden I was in a different state of consciousness. And so I asked him the question about Sustu. Well, his daughter, the princess from the tribe, she was the first person to go to university, to go to college. And she had told her father about what she learned about sisters, but also about trauma. And so he said something like, trauma is not, well, in one of my other books, In an Unspoken Voice, I write that trauma is not just what happens to us, or it's primarily what happens to us, but what happens to us in the absence of that connected, present, empathetic other. And so anyhow, in a way, I realized the importance of that. But he really extended that understanding, because he said that, you know, when there's a tear in the society, in the fabric of the society, that's the fertile ground at which trauma can grow, sisters can go. And there was an example of that. They described, there was this woman from the tribe. She had diabetes, so she was pregnant. Pregnant with twins. So she was taken to the hospital, which was a few hours. That was the nearest hospital. And tragically, the babies died. The twins died. And she was in a profound depression, of course. And they tried all different kinds of drug medications, but to no avail. And finally, they wanted to give her shock treatment. And so they had to get an okay from, you know, somebody at the tribe. And they were horrified with this. And they snuck out in the middle of the night, fashioned a ladder up to the window for her room. And they brought her down and brought her back to the tribe. And she was just sitting like this, just in despair. But they didn't require anything. She was just allowed just to be there. And when they would do their movement, their drumming, their ritual, they're very powerful, you know, when they let us do it. Within a few minutes, I was in an altered state of consciousness. And then one time, one of the people in the tribe started to cry, and another one. And then they were all crying, and this woman started to cry. And then she was out of the depression. I mean, she was still processing the grief of the loss, but she was no longer in despair. And that's what is necessary, that we've lost, because we are not community oriented anymore, or by and large we're not. And there was also an anthropologist that I came across, Colin Turnbull, and he was in what's pejoratively called a subjectivist type of anthropologist. So he actually lived with these pygmy, the forest pygmy people, mm-hmm. for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And he did make notes, of course, but he wasn't like checking how many times did they do this and then what did they do next and so forth. But he really learned about the feeling. Mm-hmm. And what happened when somebody lost somebody dear to them, the group would come together and they would cry together mm-hmm. all night long. Mm-hmm. And then the next day, in the morning light, they would go in deep into the forest and they would drum and dance in ecstasy, in joy. Mm-hmm. And I'm teaching a class in Germany this year, which is called Grief, Joy, and Return to the True Self. Mm-hmm. But see, we are just so emotionally illiterate,
yes,
with these kinds of things. And and we have much to learn. We have much to learn from people who are different than we are.
Yes. Can we just keep you all day? Oh, I want to have you just continue to tell us all of the stories. I love it. There's so much wisdom here. We want to make sure that we're respectful of your time, though, and we have a quick little round of lightning questions that we ask all of our guests, okay. If you would appease us.
That was the fastest hour ever. I'm like, no.
I know. I'm like, oh, we're at the end of the hour.
Forewarned. Okay.
All right. Well, Dr. Levine, the first question that we always ask is, who have been your greatest teachers, mentors, people who have impacted your journey up to this point?
Yes. Actually, there's a section in the book, on the autobiography, that's exactly about that. Mm. First one is titled, The Four Most Important Women in My Life. Mm. And the chapter after that is The Four Most Important Men in My Life.
Beautiful.
And the important women have really... When I first came out to Berkeley, I was so disembodied. I didn't know I had a body. Mm-hmm. And my friend Jack, he was at the Green Gulch Meditation Center. Mm-hmm. And there was a class given, or a workshop given by a woman named Charlotte Selvers. And she's pretty amazing. When she was 98, she eloped with her 50-year-old gardener.
Okay.
Yes.
Taught until the age of 104.
Wow.
So anyhow, there was this workshop that was in this wonderful, this magnificent church at the top of Gary Street in San Francisco. And my friend Jack was able to get me in, even though I wasn't part of that, you know, that meditation. And so I was there, and there were all of the different monks who were, you know, from that center. And we would have to hold the stone and feel the weight and feel the texture and feel the temperature. Mm-hmm. And we'd just be walking around the room, feeling our feet, I thought this is the most ridiculous thing. And I remember catching an eye with one of the monks, and I said, how was this for you, this class? And he said, big headache. Finally, at the end, she had us lay down on the floor, and she gave us some guidance to feel our breath coming from our feet into our lungs, going from our lungs down into our belly and into our feet. And of course, I'm a scientist at that point. I'm doing my doctoral work. And I realized something like, that's impossible. You can't breathe through your feet. Well, boy, I discovered how wrong I was. But it was the awareness mm-hmm. bringing together. And then at the end of the workshop, it was at the twilight. And we walked out and we looked down into the valley and across to the Bay Bridge. Mm-hmm. And it was the most beautiful sight that I had ever seen. So I realized something profound had happened by learning to attend to my body. Mm. That was really the beginning. And then I worked with another woman named Magda Proskauer, who was a physiotherapist who did breathing work. And then with a woman named Ida Rolf, who developed Rolfing, mm-hmm. and how important it was to be taken under her tutelage. Mm-hmm. And then finally, a woman named Mira Mira Rothenberg, who wrote a book called The Children with Emerald Eyes. Mm-hmm. And I spent much time with her. And the way she worked with these kids, she followed her gut. She followed her heart. I mean, she was also an incredibly articulate writer. Mm-hmm. But she was, and she came from, she also wrote, but she really wrote from her guts and from her heart. Mm-hmm. And so these are the four women that have been so formative in my developing the work. And I just want to honor them and also these other four men for what they've taken me and taken me under their wings. Mm-hmm. And I've always pondered, what was it that brought us together?
Yeah.
And the nearest thing I can come up with is that we are part of a cabal, that there was something that really, a force that I wasn't aware of, and I don't even know if they were aware of, that was bringing us together.
Mm. Believe that. Love it. I'm guessing I know who your friend Jack was. I'm thinking it's Mr. Jack Kornfield.
No, it wasn't.
Oh, was it? I was like, that sounds like something Jack Kornfield would bring you into.
That could have been Jack Kornfield.
That could have been.
Jack Kaplan.
Okay.
It also started with a K. Yeah, no, Jack and I have become good friends, and I just adore he and his wife, Trudy.
Yeah.
And he wrote some a beautiful endorsement of the book.
Yeah.
I think that, brilliant, moving, and wise.
Yeah.
And I was just touched that so many of my friends that have really stood with me in this difficult task and gave me the support and the courage.
Yes.
With it. Yeah.
Okay. So the second question is, and what comes to mind first when you think of this concept or this word flow, right? So that state that we get into where time just doesn't exist.
Yeah. Well, trauma is about fixity. Mm. And transforming trauma is going from fixity to flow. Mm. And flow is that sense of energetic movement in our bodies. That is experienced as flow, as this inner movement. And, I can never pronounce this guy's name. He's famous for writing a book called Flow.
Mm-hmm.
And he really talks about that, Mikhail something or other. And this is a state that I think this is our natural state of being. I think that's what flow is. But trauma and over-socialization has taken us away from that.
Yes.
Healing trauma, transforming trauma, is surprisingly takes us to that sense of flow, inner flow. And again, it's one of the wonderful side effects of trauma transform.
Yeah.
That sense in our bodies, in our being, in our whole being of flow, of movement, of inner movement and inner flow.
Mm.
Beautiful. Dr. Levine, what breaks your heart?
Oh, God. Oh, I'm sorry. The state of the world.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
It's heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely heartbreaking. Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, what's also going on with the state, what's the word for that? Where the destruction of our natural environment is also so deeply troubling. But we need to find a presence in ourselves, the flow, and in ourselves, and not get sucked into that.
Yes.
So in Tibetan, this is seen as the Kalahari period. And it's a period of extreme disintegration.
Hmm.
But if we get through it, there'll be light on the other side.
That's right.
I kind of hold that in my heart.
So do we.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so the last question.
Oh.
Don't worry. It is, what's your favorite food?
Oh my God, my favorite food. Boy, you're not easy asking these easy questions. Oh gosh. favorite food? Well, you know, I'm on the road a lot, traveling, or it was a little bit less now, but still I am. And I'm so glad when I get home and I can make my own food. And even though some of the food that I am exposed to when I'm traveling, some of it's wonderful in many ways, but really it's such a wonderful, it's just a relief to get home and to cook my sweet potatoes and my vegetables and just enjoy them. And yeah,
I feel that.
Beautiful. Well, Dr. Levine, I really want to thank you, not only for the way that I know that you have impacted both Vanessa and I and the work that we do, but countless others, but also, you know, I was thinking as you were talking about what breaks your heart, how much the way that you speak and have always spoken about our ability to transcend these traumatic experiences that we can make and transform, thank you, that we can sort of make an identity out of, and that it is actually possible to not have that be the case. And it's always just felt so unbelievably inspiring to me. A lot of times in a world that tells us that this is just going to be what this is, you know? So thank you for the way that you speak about resiliency and the way that we are capable of slowing down and doing this work.
And resilience is the core here.
Yes. Yes.
And that's what in somatic experiencing, what we help people evoke is that resilience.
Yes. Thank you so much, Dr. Levine.
Hey, oh, and if they want to know more about somatic experience, they can go to somaticexperiencingoneword.com.
Yes.
And it also connects with my nonprofit that lists all the therapists in the world who have been trained in this way.
Yep.
And
we're going to put it all in the show notes too.
I'm sure you'll take care.
No, we're gonna link the book. Got to go out and get that. We're gonna put all the SE, all that info. So if you were driving and you weren't able to take notes while you were listening, just go ahead and go to the show notes, and it'll all link out.
Well, thank you, Denny, and thank you, Vanessa.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Cheaper Than Therapy.
If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to share it with a friend, subscribe, and give us a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
And if you want to connect with us more, find us on Instagram at Cheaper Than Therapy, the podcast.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.